This is Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Keck. Historically, Vermont has always had a strong agriculture and food industry, but in 2009, state lawmakers drafted legislation to help make those industries even stronger, to make local healthy food more accessible, and to help create food and farm industry jobs along the way. The farm-to-plate concept was born, but there had to be a strategic plan drawn up to do it, a roadmap for the state to follow. That job fell to the Vermont Sustainable Jobs Fund, which released its strategic farm-to-plate plan in 2011. Ellen Kaler is the executive director of the Vermont Sustainable Jobs Fund, and she joins us today to talk about the farm-to-plate program. Ellen Kaler, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thanks for having me on, Nina.
Well, before we talk about some of the goals of the program, can you give us some idea of the various groups that are involved and make up the farm-to-plate network?
Sure. I mean, all of the work that's being done here is in large part because of the incredible growing consumer demand. So we don't want to leave consumers out of this understanding of why our food system is growing so rapidly. But it's in part the reason that the farm-to-plate strategic plan request was made was because there were so many organizations that had been pioneering for so many years and making things happen. Organizations like NOFA Vermont and Shelburne Farms and the Vermont Fresh Network, UVM Extension, Intervale Center, Rural Vermont, those were just some of the early pioneer organizations that really helped to get the local food movement and the organics movement in the state bubbling up, in addition to all the work that our dairy industry organizations do. And it was from that excitement and that new farmers coming into the mix, new farmers markets popping up all over the place, that level of excitement is really, I think, what spurred the legislature on in 2009 to want to pass the bill.
Well, and you mentioned that a lot of these organizations had been working for a long time. So how does the farm-to-plate network help them all connect in more productive ways?
Well, after we released the plan in 2011, we created the farm-to-plate network, which is now over 300 organizations. And these organizations are not just nonprofits. They're for-profit businesses, state agencies, educational institutions, capital providers. Our working theory is that by working smarter and more collaboratively, that we can actually accelerate the rate at which our food system is developed. And in fact, that's actually what we're finding out. So all of these organizations come together within this network around various working groups and task forces and cross-cutting teams. And we're looking for those big projects that no one organization can pull off on their own. So that's a really unique feature. And it's something that's starting to have legs in other parts of the country as well, as people are really looking at what we're doing here.
So I can hear some people saying, why do we need kind of a state-organized organization to do this? Can't these organizations reach out to each other on their own? And doesn't that happen with like-minded industries anyway?
It happens to a certain extent. That's very true. But we have actually seen an increased amount of collaboration because of farm-to-plate. Part of it is that we have a common agenda now. We have this plan which provides a basic roadmap forward. It's not prescriptive in saying that we're going to do X, Y, and Z exactly, but what it does is it paints a bigger picture about the opportunity, and it helps people to realize, oh, this is what my organization's role can be in this. So the Agency of Agriculture is extremely active and involved in the farm-to-plate network, and they've assigned a lot of their staff to work on this. Coming together along with the for-profits, with nonprofit organizations and the others that are part of the network, helps us to share market intelligence in a much faster way. And that then leads to really creative, innovative ideas that I just don't think would happen otherwise.
So talk about how a farmer or a food entrepreneur might use the farm-to-plate network to either start a business or grow her existing business. Because I think part of, one of the major goals is to help food entrepreneurs start up businesses to create job growth, to boost the state's economy. But take us down to sort of an individual level. Walk me through how the program might help one person, entrepreneur.
Sure. I can give you a very concrete example with the Mad River Food Hub, actually, in Waitsfield. Robin Morris, who's a local entrepreneur, read various sections of the Farm to Play strategic plan, where we had in the planning document itself, we really had the entrepreneur and the farmer in mind. So we were looking for data and trends that were, in essence, market research. A lot of our farms and food businesses are small. They don't have dedicated staff to be able to do market research. They often are going on their hunch, or they're talking to some other people to get a sense of market signals. But we wanted to provide a more comprehensive view of what was really changing in the marketplace so that these farmers and entrepreneurs could take advantage of those opportunities. So what Robin did was he looked at what was needed by smaller producers. And many of them were saying, you know, I'd really like to make a value-added product, but I need to have food safety plans written, and I don't have the money to have my own building or to have all of my own equipment. So what he put together in the Mad River Valley was a 4,000 square foot shared use facility that individual farmers and small food entrepreneurs can rent to be able to either make vegetable value-added products, meat value-added products, or for the first time ever, combined vegetable and meat products. So Joe Bewley's Screaming Ridge Farm Soups, for instance, Joe's Soups, uses the Mad River Food Hub to produce his soups. Without a facility like that, it would be really hard for him to enter certain types of markets. Robin used the farm-to-plate strategic planning documents to help inform his decision about what type of food hub to create and the level, the size, the scale, the scope of what that business was going to provide.
So looking at the Mad River Food Hub as an example, can you also point to jobs that are being created because of it? You know, companies that, you know, maybe somebody that started selling their product at a local farmer's market that is now using that food hub to crank out their production.
Yes. I mean, that's in large part what we have been identifying as the need here is really an infrastructure continuum, so that a lot of times in Vermont, we have a lot of folks that start making products in their kitchens, and then they need to graduate into something that's more like a shared use facility, like the Mad River Food Hub or the Food Venture Center up in Hardwick, for instance. And then maybe they graduate out of that and they move to a co-packer like Freedom Foods in Randolph or Vermont co-packers over in Williston, for instance, Green Mountain Co-Pack, where they can actually contract with somebody to make their products for them so that they can then focus on the more of the R&D of the products and marketing and sales. And then eventually they can have their own rented facility, or they could own their own facility. So what we've identified in the strategic planning process was that there was a need to have all types of infrastructure like that available, as well as good technical assistance all along the way and financing for these types of businesses. And that if the state could provide, the state not meaning the state of Vermont as the government, but the state generally, the global we here, if we could actually provide that environment, that businesses would in fact be investing and growing. And the report we came out with last week, where we looked at Department of Labor data, really does show that that is in fact happening. Over 2,200 jobs have been created in the last 4.5 years. And most of those, 1,500 of them, are in food manufacturing. So it's companies like Green Mountain Coffee Roasters, Vermont Smoke and Cure, Black River Produce. There's just so many different businesses that have added 5, 10, 1,500 jobs that they're responding to consumer demand and the opportunity that they're really seeing out there.
I want to delve into that job issues in just a bit, but I want to remind listeners, if you're just tuning in, we're talking about Vermont's Farm to Plate program. It was launched in 2009 as a way to help agriculture and food-based businesses in the state grow, as well as helps expand production and distribution of locally made foods. Ellen Kaler is my guest. She's the executive director of Vermont Sustainable Jobs Fund, which is overseeing the Farm to Plate program. Listeners, have you been involved with any part of the Farm to Plate network? Are you noticing more locally produced foods for sale in your area? And would you like to see more? You can give us a call and share your thoughts at 1-800-639-2211 or post your thoughts on our website, vpr.net/Vermont Edition. So, Ellen Kaler, we were talking about jobs, and as you mentioned, I think Vermont's food system added at least almost 2,100 jobs, and I think it was 199 establishments since 2009. You were saying many of them are manufacturing. What, you know, when you look at all of those jobs that have been created, are they jobs that have benefits, that are full-time, that have a livable wage?
We can't know for sure because when the Department of Labor data is assembled, that level of detail is not made available. But our general sense is that in food manufacturing, we do know that the wages, average wages that are paid within food manufacturing are typically quite a bit higher than, say, production agriculture, farm labor. We do know that wages run in the $13 to $18, $20 an hour range is the sort of average. But I think what's important to understand here is that we took a food systems approach, meaning that we were looking at all of the steps from getting food from the fields, the whole growing, the inputs, the growing of it, the processing of it, the distribution of it, the moving it through the system to finally reach our plate. There are so many different types of jobs that are connected to food. So you can be working in the food industry as a food writer or as a food marketer or as a line worker in a food manufacturing setting. So there's lots of different jobs that are connected. You could be a food truck driver that is literally taking food from a whole bunch of different farms here in Vermont and taking it down to markets in Boston and New York and Connecticut, for instance. So it's hard to say exactly what the jobs, the wage numbers are, but it's a pretty good range. You can definitely have a career in the food system.
Listeners, what do you think of the Farm to Plate Network? How could it help you? Are you a food entrepreneur? Are you thinking of selling some new products at your local farmer's market? Or would you like more locally produced foods in your grocery store, at your neighborhood co-op? Let us know your thoughts. You can call us at 1-800-639-2211. We're talking about the Farm to Plate Network today on Vermont Edition with Ellen Kaler. She's the executive director of the Vermont Sustainable Jobs Fund. Tara Kelly is also on the line with us. She's the executive director of Rutland Area Farm and Food Link, which has really been active in promoting local foods and local farms in the Rutland area. Tara Kelly, thanks for being on the program today.
Thanks, Nina. Nice to talk to you.
So I think of RAFL, Rutland Area Farm and Food Link, as almost a local version of the statewide Farm to Plate program. Is that a fair comparison? Mm-hmm.
I would agree with that to a certain degree. When we started in about 2005, we also were looking at what would it take to build out the local food system locally, and with an emphasis on the economic viability of the farms. You know, we really started as trying to fill a gap from the transition from, you know, seeing a lot of dairy farms being lost to what was the next wave in agriculture that we could be supportive of. And what we settled on is that we could direct local people to invest in the farms through how they chose to make their purchases. So that's been a big emphasis of ours from the beginning. But we also get into other aspects of the food system as well, like providing technical assistance to the farmers so they can be more successful and making sure that the food is available across the economic spectrum.
And I've just noticed since RAFL began in the Rutland area where I live, when I go out to eat at the restaurants, they all promote local produce, where they get their local meat. I mean, that's on the menus now, where maybe 5-10 years ago I wasn't noticing that as much.
It's true. I mean, there's been statewide efforts around that through Vermont Fresh Network for quite a while, and they've done a great job, but their tendrils hadn't quite penetrated the Rutland market. So I think that, you know, a big part of what's happening down here is that there is far more attention being paid to the local food movement. I mean, you see it in our thriving farmers markets. You see it in new businesses starting up, like the Stone Valley Community Market in Pulteney. That's an outlet for local food. And as you said, the restaurants. I mean, the restaurants that were already doing some local continue to do that. You know, the Frontiers, like the folks up at Red Clover Inn or down at Victorian Inn or Three Tomatoes. But then you have new enterprises like Roots Restaurant that have come on board and were so successful so immediately that he's now opened a second restaurant called The Bakery. So there's quite a lot going on, and the customers are looking for it and they're responding. I think what's behind the scenes and what I'm sure you'll get into is just the complications of it. Everyone says, well, why can't I just get that local food in my grocery store? And that's really where the Farm to Plate Network and the work of our organization and many others are trying to unravel those puzzles and try to make those things work.
Well, Tara, talk about how the Farm to Plate Network has helped RAFL. How are you sort of branching out beyond Rutland County? And how are you cooperating and collaborating?
Yeah, great. So that's what has changed since the Farm to Plate Network came online, is that we are much more aware of what's going on around the state and better connected to our other partners. So some specific examples are the whole farm to institution and schools. So we had made quite a few inroads with our local hospital, you know, the medical centers, doing some work around local foods. We had many of the schools were moving in that direction. But there's only so far those things can get with just like our small local work. And what we found is that by connecting with Vermont Feed and other partners in the state to really unravel and better understand the dynamics with farmed institution, that, you know, now we have a much more holistic view. We don't see that we're going to be the only solution. We know that we have to be working with the food service providers, with the distributors, with all the other players that have an effect on moving that food from the farm to the plate, if we're really going to effectively change the system and get a lot more of that food flowing.
Tara, can you give a specific example of a Rutland area business that you can point to and say, yes, that person has directly benefited by the farm-to-plate efforts, either with networking, distribution help, or something like that?
Sure. One of the things that has benefited would be, well, I guess this is what works off of the example Ellen gave a little while ago. So there was a small local food entrepreneur in our area. His name is Joe Bossman. He's a graduate of Green Mountain College. And he was in our area. He's kind of figuring out what he wanted to do in the food system, trying out different things. He settled on Vermont Bean Crafters, making bean burgers. And he was doing it out of a very small facility on a farm. And it was through the efforts of the Farm to Plate Network and, you know, really getting that facility up and going in Waitsfield that he's been able to rapidly expand his operations. And it's a very, you know, very serious business that's providing to distributors. And that, you know, that wouldn't have happened without the connections that were being made. I think some other examples are, if I think of folks like Radical Roots Farm or Duchess Farm or Evening Song Farm, some of the vegetable producers in our area that had it within their mission to provide food to schools and provide food to people with lower incomes, but they just don't have the extra labor and time to make that happen. Our work is helping them connect to consumers in ways that they just couldn't. And it's through the volunteer energies of people, it's through our connections with other people around the state that those things are really thriving.
Awesome. Tara Kelly is Executive Director of RAFL, the Rutland Area Farm and Food Link, which is a member of the Farm to Plate Network. Thanks, Tara.
Okay, thank you.
We'll take more of your calls and we'll continue our discussion about the efforts that are ongoing to expand the availability and production of local foods. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Keck. We're talking today about Vermont's Farm to Plate program. It's a statewide effort to increase local food production and local food consumption, to improve food education and safety, as well as marketing, create better food distribution networks. My guest is Ellen Kaler of the Vermont Sustainable Jobs Fund, which oversees the Farm to Plate Network. We'd love to hear your thoughts on this program. 1-800-639-2211 is the number to call. Again, that's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post your comments on Vermont Edition's Facebook page. Let's go to the phones now. Let's go to Montgomery and take a phone call from Kimberly. Hi, Kimberly. Thanks for waiting. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm calling in because I think this is an excellent program. And my husband and I recently moved up to Vermont, actually just in October, from Massachusetts, because Vermont really is seen as the mecca of farm-to-table, local food, just that whole program of knowing your farmer and knowing where your food comes from is something that, you know, Vermont really stands for. So we moved up here in October, and we actually decided to start up a restaurant that opened on Thursday in Montgomery Center called The Dell.
And congratulations.
Thank you. Very new, but our aim is to support these local farms and farmers directly by using their products to feed the community.
Now, you sound like you're aware of the Farm to Plate Network. Have you been able to link into that organization for help with your restaurant?
That's something that I'm looking into now because it's so new. I'd say we found out we were taking over this restaurant maybe about a month ago, maybe a month and a half ago. It's all been really quick, but programs like this in Vermont that help even small restaurants like us utilize these farms and farmers and local food are just an incredible resource, not only for us as business owners, but for the community and supporting, you know, their direct neighbors that have a beef
sure.
farm. Why order beef from California when you can just go down the street and pick it up from the farmer?
Absolutely. Well, Kimberly,
absolutely.
thanks for that call, and good luck with your new restaurant. Let's take a call now from Randolph. Let's check in with Jim. Hi, Jim. Welcome to the program.
Hello. I've been farming full-time for almost 3 years now, and we're loving it. We're doing mostly protein, a lot of pigs, turkeys, chickens. People ask us sometimes, you know, what's your biggest obstacle? And, you know, is it the weather? Is it the feed prices? Is it taxes? Is it, you know, that sort of thing? And I have found so far that our biggest headache is, believe it or not, people, even well-intentioned restaurants, we have a lot of restaurants as customers, people are not communicating well. They're not answering emails. They're not answering phone calls. We have a full list and menus we send out with details about how we raise our animals and photos and everything. And it's like you hear the crickets chirping or the tumbleweeds rolling.
Jim, are you talking about trying to market your product, get the word out to folks about what you're selling?
Yeah, we do have a pretty good market now. We have 6 to 8 good, strong restaurant accounts, some of them very high-end restaurants.
Osteria
Panasalut in Woodstock.
When you say that you're having difficulty communicating and people aren't answering emails, who are you meaning by that?
A lot of retail and some restaurants. You know, I think the best thing they could do, I mean, even places that it's in their tagline, their byline, how they're advertising, is supporting the local farms. And my opinion is, if you want to support your farmer, just respond to their communications. That's the baseline for us. Because, you know, it's like the worst thing you can do is not give someone an answer. We'll hear no. If you're not interested in our product, you don't like our product, if it's the quality was off, we want to hear no.
Sure, Jim, let me pick it up with our guest, Alan Kaler, because I think you brought up an interesting point that the Farm-to-Plate Network on a much larger scale and a small scale is trying to address, and that's communication between all of the players. Alan Kaler, can you comment on that?
Yeah, that's one of the main reasons why we created the Vermont Food System Atlas, which is at vtfoodatlas.com, and we can put that link up on the website. At vtfoodatlas.com, it's really intended to be a great forum for connecting and being able to access information, so you can get all the sections of the strategic plan on there. You can join working groups if you're a member of the actual network. The network uses it as a communications vehicle. There's a mapping function so that you can see where different food businesses exist within the state. You can get listed on the Atlas. There's just a ton of resources, and our hope is that by providing that kind of resource, that, again, it sort of accelerates the connectivity amongst everybody that's engaged.
All right. I'd like to bring in another voice to the discussion right now. Janice St. Ange is the president of the Flexible Capital Fund. They help natural resource businesses like farmers and foresters, among others, to get financing, and they frequently work with the Vermont Sustainable Jobs Fund. Janice St. Ange, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thanks for having me, Nina.
One of the big obstacles, I think, for a lot of new businesses, not just food-related or agriculture businesses, is getting startup capital or money to grow and expand an existing business. I'm wondering, is it harder for farmers and food-related businesses to get financing than other types of businesses?
Well, Nina, I would have to say that I think there, all things being equal, it may not be any harder. I think the biggest challenge that businesses face, whether they're starting up or growing, is understanding where to find the capital and making sure that they have that right match of capital based on their size, their stage of growth, and how they want to scale up the business. So oftentimes, I think people think that it's about access or availability of capital, but it's more about understanding how to find it and then how to put a financing package together that's going to meet the needs of you as an entrepreneur and your growing business.
So how is your organization working with the Farm to Plate Network to help provide some of that capital?
Sure. So the Flexible Capital Fund is actually providing a type of capital called royalty financing or revenue share financing that hadn't existed in Vermont before. There's a lot of new and innovative ways and financing structures that have come up over the last couple of years, and we are providing what is more like equity than debt financing, but it is still considered debt. So essentially, for a growing value-added agricultural business or forestry business, we would provide a debt-like structure and get repaid based on a percentage of revenue over time. So that growing business isn't locked into a fixed monthly principal and interest payment, but their payments can fluctuate depending on how their revenue is coming in. And the whole idea is that it can be flexible as they grow, so the payments are lower when they're just starting up and they need to reinvest that capital back into the business. And as they grow and become more profitable, their payments, their larger payments based on revenue can support their growth.
Yeah, I've been surprised, Janice, when I look at some of the organizations seeking fundings on crowdsource funding sites like Kickstarter, I'm starting to see a lot more farmers, food-related products, trying to get money that way. Are traditional banks, is it difficult for some of these food entrepreneurs to approach traditional banks?
Well, I think the banks still play a very vital and active role in the agricultural lending community. But oftentimes, startup and growing businesses in this sector may not have sufficient collateral, which is really what a bank relies on when they're lending to a company, or at hard assets that they can secure, or they may not have enough operating history that a bank really needs to make a loan. So if a bank isn't able to provide the debt, there are alternative lenders like ourselves, like the Community Loan Fund, the Vermont Economic Development Authority, and others who can be a piece of the package. And sometimes it may take more than one kind of money or one type of funder to make a whole financing package happen.
All right. Well, Janice St. Orange, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Nina.
Janice St. Orange is the president of the Flexible Capital Fund. I appreciate you checking in with us today. Listeners, do you buy local food? Does it matter where your food comes from? Is local food too difficult to get or too expensive where you live? Let us know what you think. 1-800-639-2211. You can also post your questions or comments on our website, vpr.net. Just click on the Vermont Edition connection there. Let's go to the phones now and take a call from Mark. Hi, Mark. Go ahead.
Hello. Thank you. My question, I'm a longtime food-oriented person. I taught culinary arts for 20 years in Burlington Tech, and I've been on the Chittenden County's food board. And the problems I see arising from that experience has to do with middleman scale and the industrialization of some of our better products, like maple syrup. You need huge capital to get involved in stuff like that these days, and it's kind of like the education conundrum. If you want to get into it, it's overpriced and very difficult for, you know, land-rich, capital-stressed Vermonters that are the most capable of doing this stuff.
Right, and it sounds as though I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, Mark. Did you have a specific question that you wanted to bring up with Ellen, or was it more just your frustration that it's hard for startups that are on a small scale to get their foot in?
Both. I think, you know, the information needs to go both ways here. And my experience, and, you know, I'm a small-scale farmer that would like to find a value-added product or something like that. Having processing facility, which is the heart of their issue, is key to that. But also a storage facility, co-op, or some cold storage area where they could get a prorated price by quality level for whatever they grow. And it could be, eliminating the middleman that is and having a stable price.
Let me throw that to Ellen Kaler. Briefly, Ellen, what about Mark's point that it'd be helpful to have cold storage? I mean, you talked about the Mad River Food Hub before, sort of a place where people can manufacture their products. How about storing?
Storage is definitely an issue that we heard a lot during the planning process, and there is an increasing amount of storage that is coming online. Some of it is happening with private growers, such as Pete's Greens. He's building a big cold storage for himself, but there may be opportunities to provide some shared space as well over time. Organizations like the Mad River Food Hub have cold and freezer storage space that you can rent there, and they also do distribution out of their facility. There's a very large storage, commercial storage facility in Williston, actually, that has all different types of storage that's available for rent. So part of the problem, and I think one of the benefits of the Farm to Plate Network, is because of the way the industrial food system in our country has consolidated over the last 30 to 40 years, many of us have lost this information and knowledge about where you can find things. So part of what we do in the network is share market intelligence so that we have greater connectivity to know where is storage available and who, hey, who's your distributor and what's the what are they charging you and how do I get into that independent grocer? How do I reach, what are consumers really asking for? That kind of information and information sharing is so critical for business owners to then make very real, very difficult decisions about making investments in land and other types of infrastructure and really make having the intention of getting out there and growing, making products and getting it into the marketplace.
I want to dig into affordability of local food for a little bit. Steve wrote in, how does the plan address affordability of local food? How do we achieve economies of scale, rather? Oftentimes, local food does seem to be more costly. I'm not sure if that's just my impression or the real situation. And I want to bring another voice into our conversation now to talk about that. John Sales is Chief Executive Officer of the Vermont Food Bank, and he joins us now by phone. John Sales, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Nina. Glad to be here.
Well, first of all, my first point, is local food more expensive, or is that a misconception on my part?
Well, I think that is a generally held belief. There are places where I'm sure you can find local food that's less expensive. But, you know, if you compare the prices of produce at your local farmer's market and at, a place like Price Chopper, you probably would find lower price produce at Price Chopper. It is that industrial food system food that we've been talking about. And, the lettuce may have come from California, but it's still cheaper than lettuce that was grown here in Vermont.
The Vermont Food Bank is part of the Farm to Plate Network. And I'm wondering, how is your organization trying to make local foods more affordable and easier to access for all sorts of different folks in Vermont?
Well, first off, I think it's important, one thing that I always say is if we don't have a sustainable local food system that includes everyone, then it's not going to be successful. And really the challenge is finding that scope and scale to bring the cost down. And frankly, it may be that sustainably grown food is a little bit more expensive than the food we purchase in the grocery store. The food bank interacts in many ways with the Farm to Plate Network. So you had Tara Kelly on from Raffle, and Raffle, in addition to all the wonderful work they do with farmers, also has a gleaning program. So they are actually picking up the unused produce from farmers in their area and distributing that to food shelves around the state. It's not so much that the food bank has programs to lower the cost of produce that's available. Our role right now is really to make sure that whatever excess produce there is out there can be distributed to people who can't afford it. So, we distribute produce to our network of 270 partners all over the state. And that produce is coming from farms, many of whom are part of this network and are very engaged. Other organizations mm-hmm. like Salvation Farms, which on a larger scale is trying to capture that excess produce and process it and then hand it off to the food bank, and we distribute it around the state.
All right. John Sales, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
John Sales is the Chief Executive Officer of the Vermont Food Bank. I'd like to take a couple more phone calls in the few minutes we have left. Let's go to Jim, who's calling from Woodstock. Hi, Jim. Thanks for waiting. Go ahead. Are you there, Jim? All right. Let's go to Springfield and try Trevor. Trevor, are you there?
Hi.
Hi. Yeah. Go ahead. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you. I just wanted to give a little shout out to the Vermont Food Venture Center in Hardwick. I know that they're doing a lot of, informative sessions. I heard Ellen talk about, some of the most important stuff is, information for food producers. And I hear that, they're doing a lot of seminars for food nutritional labeling and things like that with, you know, Vermont labeling companies, Image Tech labels, Creative Labels of Vermont, stuff like that.
And is that going to be helpful for you? Are you a food entrepreneur?
I definitely follow. I wouldn't consider myself a food entrepreneur, but I definitely follow the scene. It's definitely going to be helpful for, you know, the Vermont producers, especially the small companies that are able to take advantage of having a company like that, you know, in the Northeast, or, you know, I'd like to see more in southern Vermont, like in Springfield.
Thanks for the call, Trevor. Alan Kaler, are there talks about other similar sorts of operations in other parts of the state? I know Rutland was trying to create one of those.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that everybody's really taking a good hard look at, is we're looking at the economics of both the Food Venture Center as well as the Mad River Food Hub. There's a food processing center down just over the border in Greenfield, Massachusetts, for instance, that has quite a nice operation going. There's a number of commissaries around the state. And part of what we need to make sure of is that the running of those facilities themselves need to be economically sustainable. So the Mad River Food Hub, for instance, is a for-profit entity. The Food Venture Center is a nonprofit entity. And it's still pretty early. They're about 2-3 years into their operations now. So we're learning a lot. And I think that as we learn more, we're going to see additional ones get cited in places where there's a strategic need for them.
Let me go to the phones. Mary in Bennington has been waiting. Mary, welcome to the program. I'm just going to ask you to keep your question brief. We only have about a minute and a half left.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, I just happened to be listening on the radio, and I'm very excited about this. I've heard of farm-to-table, but I never looked it up and really found more information. But now I'm going to. I'm very new, a new vendor at our local farmers market, and I started with just being a recycle artist, and now I'm making jam. And, you know, with the state regulations and the commentary I was listening to earlier about how much you can produce out of your kitchen before you have to take that next step, and that's exactly where I am right now, is having to make a decision about moving to the next step as far as finding a commercial kitchen that I can use. And
now you know where to look.
Yeah, I'm very excited. And I wanted to say, you asked earlier about how important it is and listeners' feelings about buying local versus the cost of...
Mary, I'm going to have to cut you off because we are out of time, and I'm sorry to do that. Listeners, you can find a lot of what we've talked about today, plus some cool interactive maps on our website, vpr.net. Alan Kaler, thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thanks for having us.
Alan Kaler is the executive director of the Vermont Sustainable Jobs Fund. More coming up on Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Keck. Men's and women's lacrosse have some significantly different rules, especially around contact in the sport. That's partly why it's even more notable that a female lacrosse player would be recruited by a men's lacrosse team. Devin Wills played lacrosse at Dartmouth and now plays for the women's U.S. national team. Recently, she was asked to try out for the men's Major League Lacrosse team, the New York Lizards. VPR's Rick Singeri spoke with Wills about professional lacrosse and breaking a gender barrier.
Devin, what was your reaction when you learned that a professional men's team was interested in you and then signed you for a tryout?
I think, you know, at first it was a huge honor. It's one of those things that it is notable because I am a female playing in a male arena. But at the same time, in my opinion, it's just another opportunity to play lacrosse and to continue to get better and to continue to compete. And I think for me, that's the ultimate goal in this entire, you know, process.
Well, how did the opportunity come about for you to get this tryout?
I was basically approached about it last year, somewhat later, and I thought that, you know, they just asked me if they thought it would be possible, and I definitely thought about it and talked with people. And basically, they said, if you want to do it, put your name into the draft, and we'll see how it goes from there, and, you know, give you a real tryout. And so that's basically what I did.
The team opens its training camp in April, where you'll have an opportunity to win a roster spot. What do you see as the biggest challenge as you prepare for that camp?
I think the speed is going to be the biggest challenge. There's obviously a big difference between men and women in terms of just natural speed and strength ability, and I think that's going to be the biggest thing to overcome. I do think that there's lacrosse-specific tasks that I'm going to have to overcome just in terms of release points, stick tricks, fakes, that kind of stuff. That is going to be another challenge. This is not going to be easy whatsoever, but it is something that I can only get better from experiencing.
So have you played against men before? And if so, how have you done when you played in that game?
I've grown up sort of playing in and out of the men's leagues and the winter leagues and just having some of the male counterparts on teams at Dartmouth shoot on me. And then even after college, getting ready for World Cups, have had several other shooters that are boys. And I think that it's something that the timing is very different just in terms of their releases and how hard they shoot, obviously. But I think, you know, it's something that there are times where I see the shot and maybe it goes in or maybe it doesn't. You know, I kind of know I could get it or, you know, I shouldn't have it. So it's just a matter of controlling what I can control as opposed to trying to gauge myself compared to somebody else.
And we should mention you play goalie. So what kind of training are you going to do to prepare for tryouts for this position?
Well, right now I'm just finishing up with the U.S. team for this year. We have one last event at the end of January down in Florida. So I'll be gearing up to cater my training more towards the men's side and the men's game after that. But obviously I'm doing a lot of strength training, trying to put on some extra power and some extra strength in my legs and my arms. And I'm getting as many male shooters out there with me that I possibly can and trying to put them into little drills. And I think for them, they're kind of reliving their glory days of college as well. So it's a good balance, I think.
You graduated from Dartmouth in 2006. You've coached at several colleges, but what kind of playing opportunities exist for a female lacrosse player after college graduation?
Well, the U.S. system is basically the main avenue that you can have in order to play. There's a lot of more amateur leagues, I guess, that you could do, but the U.S. team is really the only competitive international, you know, we don't get paid, but I guess you would consider it professional on some level that you have after you graduate.
And how many games per year would you play with the national team?
We each year, it depends on the World Cup, similar to soccer where you play every 4 years in a World Cup. So in a non-World Cup year, we have two or three practice weekends a year, and then we play in to competition weekends where we'll play college teams and either get them ready for their fall ball or even their preseason. But then in the World Cup year, the training's a little bit more. So we're just coming off of a World Cup in 2013. And when you have a World Cup year, there's training camps. And then the actual World Cup itself is 10 days.
Mm-hmm. So what heroes or role models do you look to for inspiration as you prepare for this opportunity?
I think just like anybody else and any other girl, I mean, we've always had male role models, I think, in these situations. And the same thing goes for me. I remember growing up in Chris Anderson. He was a goalie for the Canadian national team, and he played at Virginia. And this is dating way back into the 90s. And I used to watch his game tapes all the time on VHS. And I just loved the way he played and his, you know, intensity and his presence in the cage. But I've also had a lot of other role models just from other sports. You know, ice hockey is a sport I grew up playing. Sidney Crosby is a huge one. So I think there's a lot of different people you can look to, and I think that's a huge part of being a well-rounded athlete is just being open-minded and getting as many perspectives as you can.
And what pressure do you feel as kind of a standard bearer or groundbreaker getting this tryout for a men's professional team?
I'm trying not to look at it so much as pressure. I think there, like I said, it is a noteworthy story from one aspect, but at the same time, it's for me an opportunity to get better and it's an opportunity to compete. And I'm really, really grateful to the Lizards organization and them giving me a legitimate tryout. But I think for me, it's a matter of controlling what I can control and not overthinking anything. And when it all comes down to it, it's doing the basics and doing what I can to stop the ball, because ultimately that's going to be what they're judging me on. And if I'm good enough, I'm good enough. And if I'm not, I'm not. And I have a ton of respect for them that they're going to do exactly what they need to do to make sure that their team and their organization is taken care of and is in the best position possible.
Devin, best of luck at training camp this April.
Thank you very much.
Devin Wills is a 2006 graduate of Dartmouth College and a member of the U.S. Women's National Lacrosse Team. She's also the first woman who's been invited to try out for the men's professional lacrosse team, the New York Lizards. And that's it for today. Tomorrow, renters and landlords. They may not always love each other, but both need each other to survive. We'll hear both sides of this love-hate relationship from those trying to keep the partnership amicable. And we'll talk to the women who started, to the woman who started a Yelp-style website for Burlington renters. Email your questions or comments about the challenges renters and landlords face to VermontEdition at vpr.net. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wing, with production assistance from Tim Johnson. Peter Biello directed the program. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. From PEG TV Studios in Rutland, I'm Nina Keck. Thanks for listening.